And also, I guess I learned that when we're writing, I want everything we're doing to be very personal and very authentic. I guess for me, I needed to have more of a line between real life me and performance gig me, because otherwise when you get a kicking, it's literally right in your face.
It's How to Be Amazing, brought to you by PRX. I'm Michael Ian Black. Friends, I begin today with a confession. I am now old enough to recall a time, and this is back in the last century, when sort of synth pop music, new wave music, your Depeche Modes, your New Orders and such were kind of the vanguard, and then they kind of dribbled away. And then at some point, it happened again, and the world was telling me synth pop is going to make a revival, and rock and roll was dead, and then YouTube moved to Berlin, and I kept waiting for it to happen, and it never happened, and now it seems like maybe it has happened. I was afraid that all music would sound, you know, like, and there is that, but now there is a synth pop band that I like. They're called Churches. You've heard of them. Their lead singer, Lauren Mayberry, is my guest today. She is a Glaswegian. That's right, right?
Yeah, you did that well.
Thank you.
Other Americans I've spoken to don't have any idea what that is.
So. Oh, yeah. I practiced it a little bit as I was eating lunch. In my head, I was practicing it, not out loud. Lauren's just moved to Brooklyn. She's a new New Yorker. She's a former journalist. And she now uses those skills and her platform as a certifiable blue checkmark verified rock star to speak out on behalf of women and women's issues. She's also the co-founder of TYCI, which stands for Tuck Your Cunt In, a feminist collective which serves to help women, now I'm quoting now, break down misguided notions of feminism and gender boundaries. Lauren Mayberry, welcome to How to Be Amazing.
Hello. Thank you for having me.
Oh, my pleasure. So, I don't have any concept of what a Glaswegian childhood would be like. Is it how, now that you live in New York and you're sort of seeing what a New York day-to-day existence is like, can you contrast for me?
I tell myself, I was like, I live in the city. I've lived in Glasgow for 10 years. I'll be fine. And no, it's very busy here. It's like, I feel like it's a nice mixture of things that people are busy and are rushing around and will shout at you on the subway. But also I feel like it's a very friendly place. And I don't know. I don't have any negative feelings about New York in the way that
They'll come. So.
Oh, okay. Yeah, if people keep yelling at me, then I'll just start yelling, fuck you, people. But I grew up in the countryside in Scotland. Okay. So that's why I'm extra careful when crossing roads, because you never had to do that. So.
There were no roads to cross.
There were roads, but there was no cars really. But right.
Just wagons being drawn by horses and such?
Essentially, yes. but
did you grow up in the 1830s?
I did, yes. Nobody in Scotland got electricity until after like grunge.
So, understood.
Yeah.
What prompted the move?
I don't know. I guess we travel a lot with the band, which is amazing. But I guess you don't really see a lot of those places. You can just dip in and out. And whenever we've been to New York for shows, I always thought it seemed like a really interesting place. But there was a lot of creativity and different kinds of creativity. And I figured, I'm 28, I don't have anything necessarily keeping me in a certain place. So I thought it'd be good personally to go outside my comfort zone a bit.
New York, you're saying you sought out for its creativity. Was there something, creatively speaking, that was lacking for you in Scotland?
The Glaswegian music scene is really diverse. There's loads of different kinds of music that's getting made and things like that. But I kind of feel like at this point, not that we've done everything that can be done there, but it is a small town. And I feel like to an extent, everybody does know everyone, and that's a great thing in some ways. But I guess in terms of what we'll do with Churches and what we'll do after Churches, I don't really know how that sits in that city right now, you know? And also, I guess I don't want to get stuck in the mold of the person that writes about being on tour, because we had, you know, personal lives and all kinds of stuff, and we still do, but there's less of them because we work so much. And I suppose, like, if I am going to write anything in future, I need to have life experiences in order to write about them, so. Everyone's
touch will be repaid. I'm restrained. And you are the chief or only lyricist for Churches, is that right?
Predominantly me, yes. Martin and I co-write the ones that he sings on.
Ah, got it.
And then those guys write the instrumentation, and they'll have like a musical bed, and then we'll make a nonsense vocal to go over the top, and right. then I'll go away and put lyrics.
That's how Susu Studio back. Got written.
Is it?
I don't know. I read that one time.
I could have believed you in that moment.
No, I believe me. That's the most important thing, is that Phil Collins was singing nonsense lyrics to the tune, and Susu Studio was coming out of his mouth, and he just stuck with it. That's
a classic.
That's my apocryphal understanding of how Susu Studio.
I'm very gullible as well, so.
You are a drummer, and I am enamored with drums. I was taking drum lessons with my daughter.
I just exclaimed with joy.
Oh, it was adorable. Don't get me wrong. It was adorable, but she lost interest. Oh. And when she lost interest, I felt foolish going there by myself. But Churches has no actual drumming on it.
It does not.
There's no drumming. I feel like you're betraying something by not putting actual drums on Churches music.
I guess when we were starting the band, I like when people ask, how did it come about? What happened? You get to tell an actual nice story for once that isn't like, it was made by this guy from a record label and this guy. It was just like, I met Ian when he was recording my other band, and him and Martin were doing a studio project. So we basically made it all in a basement, never thinking it would be a live band, which is kind of why we didn't have a drummer at the start. We just programmed everything. And then I guess it just felt like three personalities were what made up the identity of the band, and adding something in, someone else in, would be a mistake. But
I know, but why can't you drum?
Well, we use V-drums in the set now. There's like three songs where we have electronic drums.
Or the other thing you do is you just bring on some session drummer on tour and you treat him like crap because he's not a member. Yeah, because he's not a member of the band. And he has to sleep on the bus when you're in hotel rooms, and he has to carry
everything.
Doesn't
get to wash.
No, he does not get to wash.
No.
But you're like, you want to tour with us, you're gonna do all the shit work.
See,
just a suggestion. Just a suggestion.
That's my favorite. Somebody a guy called The Range that toured with us for quite a long time, and is now a dear friend of ours. And now I have a fear about this. Was like, yeah, when I first met you, I thought you were very standoffish and quite rude, and that's horrible. But I think in my mind, I was like, I'm being professional. I would go in and say hello to the support band and be like, thanks so much for coming, man. But then I had shit to do.
Right.
So, now I live in fear that maybe is how I come across to people.
Now, listen, you cannot befriend the lessers.
It's all about the hierarchy. I've seen Mean Girls, I know. He can't sit with us.
No.
On Wednesdays, we were pink, I guess.
So you guys in the band, I read you saying, or heard you saying, that your recording is your writing. Can you explain how that works?
I think it's probably just a product of how the band started, but now we don't really go into a rehearsal room and rehearse songs and then write everything that way and then go in and record it for 2 weeks, like the standard, more standard rock band format is. We have a little basement studio, which is just a converted flat in Glasgow, and we will go in and we'll be demoing things and just like rolling tape, as it were, at the same time. So like everything that's on the record, we have like 20 demo versions of each thing, and it just kind of layers and layers and layers till you get to the final version. And I think it's nice because we have that kind of a record of everything we've done, and it's quite funny when you go back through your computer to find out what was like tune 7 version 3, I don't know what that was, and you hear like really old versions of things. But I've never worked like that before in any other band, but I guess for this band it just feels like it works.
Could that kind of creative process have existed 20 years ago? Or does technology allow you to do that?
Well, I think without this technology, we couldn't write that way. And also without having two producers in the band, that would be insanely expensive and too much time in a studio. And I don't know if you would get a lot done, but I guess the fact that we always have written and recorded and produced ourselves makes it easier.
When you guys were first recording in, 2012, 2013, how surprising was it to you when that first album ended up really kind of exploding? Like, it kind of came out of nowhere, yeah?
Yeah, pretty much.
How does that happen? Like, I don't understand the music business at all.
Neither do I, man.
Okay, good. I find it endlessly fascinating.
I have no idea what I'm doing. I just try and keep a serious face when people ask me questions about things I don't like.
Right. Just nod and look enigmatic.
And I'm like, we're going to have to go and have a conversation about that and then come back to you. And then I have to be like, what are they talking about? Synchronized.
So what happened? You made an album and then, or was it singles first? It was kind of singles, right?
Yeah. Like we'd written a kind of certain bulk of material, but we put a song on a blog called Neon Gold. At that point, we didn't think it would be a live band. We didn't think we would make a record. We were just writing, and we were like, oh, maybe we'll put it out online for free, or maybe we'll give the songs to somebody else or something. But the response to that tune was kind of insane. And I guess that's why it's a nice story, you know? And when teenage kids come to the show and they're like, how did it happen? You're like, for once, it's like a success story, which may not last that long, I don't know, but success story where like, the little guy won, which is nice.
All right, I have to interject now because this is the third time in the first 10 minutes that you have talked about the end of churches. Oh. You may not be aware that you're doing it.
Not because I want it to happen. I guess I'm
just... So what is the concern?
I don't know. I guess it's funny now that we get to do loads of things that we never thought we would get to do. But you see, you know, you're playing the same festival stage as bands that you have listened to for years. And yeah, I guess I never want to forget how lucky we are and just assume it's going to continue. Or maybe I'm just a pessimistic Glaswegian that when it ends, I'll be like, see, I told you. So not that I hope it isn't going to happen soon, but I need to stop doing that. Somebody pointed that out to me the other day as well. It's a bad tip.
Oh, is it just like saying the jinx doesn't happen? Is that what it is?
I think so. I think it's like a weird verbal knock on wood kind of thing. So that if it happens, I don't know. I won't be so surprised and devastated or something. I'm not sure.
You guys are, the press says you're all very close and friendly. Has the success of the band changed the friendship?
The band itself is really intrinsic to our friendship because I didn't really know Ian and Martin before we started writing together. I knew of them from around the town and being in other bands, but I didn't know them personally. In a way, not knowing them for a long time and not having tons of baggage to go into what was a pretty intense experience was a good thing. And they're both really great guys. And hopefully I'm a nice enough person that you make an effort to...
It's not what your supporting acts say. They say you're very standoffish.
Well, then I was like, we have to befriend this guy so that he doesn't think we're an asshole. There's a lot of time investment to get that out of the way. Obviously, there's good days and bad days. And if you're living that closely with people, you're living with them, you're working with them. We literally sleep like 3 feet apart and you see way too much of people in good ways and bad ways. But without sounding too cheesy, there's no other people that get what this was like, really, other than them. And it did go from... you know, us noodling around in a basement to playing on TV and playing these massive festivals. And I think we did a really good job, but I think it was good to have a break between the first and second record to kind of take stock and think about how, if this is reality now, how do we want to do it? You know, I think I felt on the first record like I was putting out a lot of fires a lot of the time. We never did anything that we didn't want to do, but I definitely had a complete imposter complex where I was like, I've got no idea what I'm doing. Like, I just play in like grungy rock bands in Glasgow. I have no idea what I'm doing here. And people are asking us questions and putting us on an equivalent pedestal to other things that I don't understand. So, yeah, I guess now I feel like we're a bit more comfortable with what it all entails. And I've tried to make an effort to be a lot more present in what we're doing rather than constantly like being like, okay, good, that's done. We didn't fuck that up. Now I'm just constantly looking forward and never like actually taking a moment to be like, holy shit, this is pretty awesome.
Did those conversations in between the first and second record, when you were sort of talking to each other about where you are, did that, those emotions that you're describing right now, did you lay those out consciously? Like, we need to just sort of accept the fact that we're a successful band now and we need to be cool with that? Or is it just a kind of maturity that came with time?
I think the writing on the record is because we know more what we want the band to be and what it is. So in that sense, I think that maturity came with time. But I don't really know how much Ian and I think everybody struggled with it to an extent, but in a different way. And I think I felt it more acutely because I was the person at the front and I never really perceived it as that. But I think there was the people make certain assumptions about female performers, certain assumptions about certain kinds of music as well. And I think I spent a lot of time not wanting to be told what I was, but I had no idea what kind of performer I wanted to be, I suppose.
What were the assumptions that you felt like you were battling?
Just that you don't have any purpose or function other than to be the shiny forelocked front of a band. And I guess I learned that everybody has an opinion about fucking everything and they will all tell you about it all the time. And if you spend, I don't know, I think I spent a lot of time accidentally soaking that up, and it can turn something that's very positive into quite negative if you feel like you're constantly defending yourself and constantly fighting to do something in a way that you want to do that. And also I guess I learned that when we're writing, I want everything we're doing to be very personal and very authentic. And I want the performance to be authentic too, but I guess for me I needed to have more of a line between real life me and performance gig me, because otherwise when you get a kicking, it's literally right in your face. So having a certain distance is probably better.
I want to get back to this idea of assumptions, particularly about women in music. But before we do that, can you define what the onstage Lauren is versus the offstage Lauren? Do you know for mm-hmm. yourself what that is?
Sometimes in social situations now, I'm like, it'd be really good if you could use the stage persona right now, because people would hear you and you wouldn't be mumbling and you wouldn't have to say things five times. Yeah, I think it was just more, I would say it's like a 50% tougher version of myself. And I think a lot of the lyrics on the new record are more assertive, and I wanted to have a performance self that kind of backed that up in a sense.
And that kind of aggression has certainly come out in different ways for you. You've become kind of famous for, as you said, defending not only yourself, but kind of this idea of, or I'll use your own words, breaking down misguided notions of feminism and gender boundaries. And you've really taken that to the nth degree. I've spent a fair amount of the last year paying attention to both Black Lives Matter movement and a lot of women in comedy having very similar issues that you seem to have within music, which is this objectification. The reason I bring in Black Lives Matter is because it seems like for both women performers, or women, I guess, in general, and Black Lives people, and I think Black people in general, so much of their brain power is taken up with either race or gender. And I wonder how much of your brain is devoted to those issues on a day-to-day basis.
I think when I was struggling with it a lot more, it took up a lot more time in a negative way, maybe. I think I was just constantly irritated or disappointed or angry about how we were getting spoken to or how people were perceiving us and what we were doing. But I don't know, since we've made more of a stance on it, and that's just part of how we operate the band, it doesn't eat into my brain as much. I think it's more a part of how we conduct ourselves and how we want to do our work. But it doesn't, I think a lot, like when it was happening to us and it felt like we were kind of floundering in it and not really sure what to do, then it was worse. Whereas I suppose now, it's interesting because somebody said to me the other day, blah, 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 being in a political pop band. And I was like, I don't really view it in that way necessarily, because the lyrics aren't Rage Against the Machine political. But I suppose even within the person, like the personal is political to an extent, and figuring out that you're allowed to take up space and you can do that in whatever way you want to. I think it took me a long time to learn that saying no or asking for something to be done in a different way isn't making you difficult or awkward or make it worse for other people. You're just asking to be treated in the same way as other people. And yeah, I guess now it just feels like it's more a part of our routine.
So in kind of setting boundaries, I guess, for your fans and for the press and for the sort of music world at large, you feel like you have seen that pay off for you?
I think so. And I think just us knowing better what we will do and what we won't do. And that sounds very, like, ungrateful. Like, we're very lucky to have this position, but I don't know. I think when we were first starting, it was strange to me that it was just assumed that I would do certain kinds of promo and the guys wouldn't come. Or when there was serious promo, they would go and answer the serious questions and I wouldn't be asked anything. Just things like that. And I guess that kind of chips away at your psychology, because I've always been a person that was a main writer in what we were doing. I'm the one that replies to all the emails and all that kind of stuff. But people just write that off. And if you're in a place of uncertainty anyway, I think that that can probably go into your brain and make you a little crazy.
You felt like you went a little crazy.
Potentially, but quietly.
Uh-huh. So quietly insane.
Yes.
So those are the most dangerous ones, you know.
Yes. And then people don't.
He was always so quiet.
She was so quiet. And then she just.
She just snapped.
I'm not angry with myself, but I'm a little disappointed in certain things when I look back on it, because I think after those things started happening, it was really annoying me. And it was, I guess it was hurtful, because it was like all the things that you've worked for now don't matter, because people are just going to say, you know, she's this idiot, cute girl on the front of the band. And that just, that shouldn't matter. But when you've worked for something that long and then people are not, well, not people, I don't know. It just feels like, oh, I don't want this to be the way that I get this. And then it's funny when we look at, I looked through like tour photos at the end of the campaign, because our friend Rachel comes on tour and takes photos for us. And you can definitely see like a, I can track a visual like downturn, where at the start of the band I was dressing normally like I would, and I put on the face paint because it was a psychological help thing. And then you can definitely tell I start wearing baggier t-shirts and shorts and sneakers and stop like putting on makeup and things like that. And I think that was just a psychological response. I was like, if I just make myself less visible and less visible, then I'll get left alone,
right? Which is, as the front person of a band, not difficult. Ideal.
No, and it's not true, really. We got just as much shit when that was happening as we did anyway, because it's not about what you look like. It's not about what you're doing. It's about people wanting somebody in that position to do a certain thing or be a certain way, I think.
Is it about, I mean, I assume it's mostly men who you get this from. Although, is it from women? Do you get these kinds of, maybe it's different.
You get the odd apologist where they're like, we had a bit of a hoo-ha or a stramash after we put the video for the song Leave a Trace on the internet. And there was a lot of people being like, well, if she's so feminist, why is she wearing a dress? Why has she slicked her hair back and all that stuff? And I noticed a lot of women were commenting on that. Not the people that were like, you're a dumb fucking whore. But they would be like, if she didn't want to be called a dumb fucking whore, then maybe she shouldn't have done that. And then to me, that's odd.
No, I've seen that video. And in the video,
I look like a dumb fucking whore?
Thank you for saying it. I was embarrassed to say it. No, I mean, you just look like, I mean, there's nothing overtly sexual about it.
Nope.
And yet, just to take it a step further, even had there been something overtly sexual within that video, like there is in, say, Beyoncé's videos, which are much more sort of sexually aggressive, my sense is, as a woman, like, you can't win. And so you have to, I don't know, I'm speechifying instead of asking questions, but it seems like you have to sort of change the rules a little bit. And it sounds like that's what you're trying to do.
I read a thing that was in the Carrie Bernstein book that she's written, and she'd said that, yes, it gets intensely frustrating when people ask her what it's like to be a female musician all the time, but she's never had any perspective on what it's like to not be a female musician, because those two conversations have always been concurrent and intertwined. So I guess for me, I know people are going to bring that up all the time, especially now, and I don't want to be wearing, like, you know, wearing things that I don't want to wear to just to make myself seem more more safe for people, or something that they won't throw stones at. Because I guess I was like, well, I am a female musician. It's part of literally my identity. And it informs me as a person and me as a writer and me as a performer. And I don't really want to bury that, you know? But I don't know. I think it makes you tougher. And it's that old cliche, but what doesn't kill you makes you stronger, ellipsis, as a performer and a writer or something, I think. Because I think I have a much more focused idea of what we want to do and how we're going to do it now than I did before all this shit happened. So really, maybe it's a blessing in disguise.
So is TYCI, did that come out of this experience, or was that something pre-existing?
TYCI, I started around the same time as we started Churches, so maybe I had an incredible foresight. I didn't know, but...
And so what was the impetus?
It was mainly just because I'd been playing shows and working in bars and stuff around Glasgow for years and years and years, and there are a lot of female artists, but you don't really see a lot of them. In the same classic with like festival bills now, like you look at large festival billings and it's predominantly white dudes, and it is mostly like that everywhere. So I don't know, I kind of thought it would be nice. It started just as a club night, like a monthly club where we would book like female bands and MCs and DJs and things. And then it grew into a website and a radio show. And it was nice. I think in hindsight, it was very good timing for me because it meant I was meeting a lot of people who were very like-minded. And then when the stuff started happening with churches, it was nice to have people that you know are coming from a genuine place, but also are on the same page with you about that stuff. Because, you know, we're hardly insanely famous or anything, but I feel like you do meet a lot of people who are not genuine and talk to you for the wrong reasons. And it's nice to have a solid base of folk that I can just generally pick up the phone and bitch to about something.
Mm-hmm. Well, I should give you a little background about myself so you even understand the context of the question. I grew up in a lesbian household where in the 70s, and as a kid, my mom was very involved in kind of the women's rights movement. And as a boy growing up in that household, I felt like feminism in many ways, and sort of living in the heart of it, was oppositional to men. Now, part of that had to do with, my mom's sexuality and sort of her relationship with my dad. But I know that sort of your definition of feminism, which I've read is just equality between the sexes, is literally that. And that's how I also define feminism. But I wonder if some part of you finds yourself warier or in tension with men in general as a result of having gone through these experiences.
I don't think so. I guess for me, any weariness with men is in a personal life that's got nothing to do with feminism or otherwise, really. Well, I suppose it all does. But I don't necessarily think that the negative responses to the band have changed the way I interact with men, because I've always been in bands with men. I've always been friends with guys. Our manager is a man, and like, they're very evolved, smart dudes. So, you know, when you get crazy bros at shows shouting at you, I'm like, well, all people are different. I don't look at that and be like, men are the enemy. And I don't really think that's the case. I guess I get a lot of people calling me a madman hater, but I've never, as far as I'm aware, indicated that was the case. And I think that comes from a place of insecurity. As soon as you question something about the status quo, people are like, oh, she's a crazy, crazy man hater. It's misery. But that's not really about what I've said necessarily. I think it's about people's discomfort with people saying anything about it, I would say.
Today I'm talking to Lauren Mayberry, the lead singer and songwriter for the band Churches. In many ways, Mayberry is living the dream. Her band is successful, they get along, they like each other, she enjoys her work, but the flip side of her growing fame has been an intense degree of public scrutiny, mainly in the form of misogynistic cyberbullying that she has had to learn to cope with. Coming up, we talk more about the pros and cons of fame, how her pessimistic view of life informed her career path, and how she is keeping the crazy in the can. You brought up your personal relationships, and I know very little about your personal life other than you recently wrote a letter for an article for Lenny magazine, which is Lena Dunham's newsletter, which deals with a lot of these issues. And it was a very kind of surprising article coming from you, which dealt with being in, it sounds like, a kind of borderline abusive relationship. It doesn't sound like it ever quite got physical, but it seems like it could have gone that way. And I think for somebody like me who knows you primarily as, or who learned about you in conjunction with this very sort of progressive feminist stance, to read that you were in that relationship, I think must have come as a shock to a lot of people.
Well, I guess from my point of view, that's maybe why it was good to share it. I tend not to talk about my personal life a lot because it's not very interesting. And also, I guess in my mind, it's not really relevant to what we're doing. If you know, you can listen to a record and there's tons and tons of personal stuff in there, but who it's about and what it's...
Well, we're going to go line by line through all
yes,
your lyrics. And
you're like, so what is that? You tell me you don't hate men, but look at that. You just trace
was
up a man.
Was that your American accent briefly?
No. Oh, well, I can't do a very good American accent.
Well, you did go
I do
like that.
Like a kind of valley girl. but then that's only when people don't understand me in restaurants. I'm lucky now I have some American pals who can translate for me. But I think my accent's not very strong. I come from a quite central area.
Yeah. But as an American, I can tell you you're wrong. It's quite strong.
Oh, is it?
Oh, yeah.
But certain words, and there's so many, turns out there's so many phrases for random things that exist in Glaswegian slang.
Okay,
we're
not going there right now. I want to talk about I want to talk about your terrible, terrible relationships.
Yes. I'm sure there's loads of slang words for that. But yeah, I guess from my point of view, I think that Lenny is a really great platform to talk about different things, and they've done so many great things so far, and it's only been around for a short space of time.
Did they approach you, or did you approach them with this?
I think we got in touch with them once we heard that it was going to happen, it was launching, and then we were just kind of brainstorming things we could do, and it was domestic violence awareness time. So I thought it'd be good to write something about that, and it wasn't insanely, it feels like it was a long time ago that happened, but it wasn't such a long time ago that I can be like, oh, it was from another time, it was another world.
It was like 3 years ago, right?
You're not going to trick me into telling you what date it was. No, no.
Well, the article
you
just...
almost tricked me.
I feel like in the article you said it was like a few years ago. Like, and the article just came out.
Damn it. Maybe I didn't proofread it as well as I thought I did. But yeah, I guess at the...
But your life has obviously changed a lot
since then. And I don't know. Part of me thinks that if I had read something like that when that was happening to me, then maybe it would have kicked me into gear a bit faster or something. And the response to it was really great. A lot of people have spoken to us about it at shows and signings and things. And I think that's a positive thing. And I can't regret any of that stuff. I think I spent a lot of time banging my head against the wall being like, so stupid, you're so stupid. But now I guess I'm like, oh, for better or worse, it informed who I am now as a person. And I'm kind of happy with where I am now. I'm sure it makes me terrible at dating people because I'm like, hi, nice to meet you. And then I run. run super fucking fast.
But are you a commitment phobe?
Well, it's funny, when I was younger, I think I was like overly romantic. I watched way too many Richard Linklater movies and I thought everything was going to be like in Before Sunrise. And now as an adult, I'm probably more able to meet people that would have that kind of, you know, a balance of equals and actually preferring conversations with. But now I'm like, you're not going to fool me because I know what happens. If I feel like this is going to go well, then I'm wrong.
Right.
And this will blow up in my face and I will be the one that gets sad about it. But I realize that's an incredibly cynical and sad way to look at it. So I'm trying to do better. Keep the crazy in the can.
Uh-huh.
You know?
Is it hard to have a personal life when you're so intimately involved with a band and touring? And does that become your life? And do you mourn sort of not having less?
I think it's a very time-consuming, all-encompassing thing. But I think now that we're more aware of what it entails, then it's easier to make sure you're trying to have some kind of work-life balance. Like, there's certain times where it's not as easy. Like, at the end of last year, we did basically 3 months solid touring, which is not great for any personal relationships of any kind. But just knowing that there will be times when you're working, I'm sure the same with you, and there'll be just times where there's intense periods of work, and there'll be times where there's loads of time off, and in a way, it's not a flexible job, but in other ways, it's the most flexible job in the world. So, if I had a 9-to-5 job and I had a partner that was in another country, it would be much harder to visit and do all those things. So, I don't know. I'm optimistic. I don't think...
I'm optimistic for you.
I hope it's on the cards. You never know.
Did you envision yourself with this career when you were younger? I mean, I know you went to school for journalism and law, but you were also simultaneously pursuing bands. What were you envisioning for yourself?
I think when I was about 17, I thought I would be in the new Jimmy Eat world, and that's how that would go for me. And then when you become not 17 and not quite as stupid or idealistic, then I guess I was like, okay.
Mayberry calls Jimmy Eat's world stupid. You heard it here first on How to Be Amazing.
No, I meant the idea that...
I know what you meant.
Like, it just seems very, I don't know, unrealistic in a way.
Mm-hmm.
But then again, that's me being pessimistic, I suppose. And I don't know, I just thought I would always want to make music, but I never thought that it would be, that I would be a person that it would happen for, if that makes sense. So I was like, I'll keep working on it and we'll see, but who knows. So I need to have a day job I like. And I was kind of starting to try and work in like documentary film stuff. So I was doing production assistant stuff and things like that. So I was lucky to have a day job I liked. For a long time I worked in bars and cafes and I didn't like it that much because I was trying to make it as flexible as possible for the band stuff. But then pretty much as soon as I started working a day job I actually liked, I met Ian and Martin, and then we form this band. And that's not a thing to complain about. Oh, I had to leave my other job I quite liked to have a job I really, really liked.
What was that job?
It was just for a small production company in Glasgow, and they make kind of adverts and documentaries and shorts and things like that.
And what were you doing?
So, answering a lot of phones, getting a lot of coffee.
Low man on the totem pole kind of thing, right?
Yes. But it's funny now when things... we made a video for the first album, and the first AD on the shoot was somebody that had worked on an advert that I'd worked on, and it took him like all day to figure it out. He was like, I think I know you from somewhere. And then I was like, we made that Dewar's Whiskey advert. And he was like, holy shit. And the director threw a coffee at me, remember that. Well, and I guess that's maybe why the support band thought I was a little standoffish thing. It hurts my feelings because, I don't know, I think you meet a lot of people in entertainment who have forgotten how to be nice people.
Has that been true for you? Because I have to say that has not been true for me.
Well, I met a lot of really, really nice people. But I think you can... I was saying this to someone the other day. I think you can tell a lot about a person from the way that they talk to a waitress or, like a crew guy. And I've definitely had a couple of things where I've met people in bands I've loved for a long time. And I won't name the band, and I love them so much now, but also when I was growing up, and it was really exciting to meet them, and I was talking to the singer, and then one of their crew guys walked past and said to him, oh, you left, just so you know, your jacket's in the dressing room, I've taken everything else out, you left it in there. And then the guy turned around and or girl turned around and said,
and that person said,
I don't think I left it in there, I think that you left it in there, so you should go get it because you work for me and all that.
Oh god.
And just when you see people do stuff like that, I'm like, well, were you always like that? Or did somebody make you think that was okay? And I don't know. And you never know who the runner or the production assistant is going to end up being. And that's not why you should be nice to them. But you should just be nice to them because you're not a dick, I guess.
Yeah.
But I've seen a lot of people who are really nice.
In my experience, the people who, and again, I will reiterate, because I think it's a misnomer about people in entertainment that they're all terrible people. Most people that I've met have been really lovely. But in my experience, the ones who are not, it seems to come from a place of deep insecurity as opposed to anything else. You know what I mean? As opposed to just being an actual monster, it seems to come from a place of feeling like their position in the world is tenuous, and so they have to assert themselves in whatever manner they can.
Sticking a flag in whatever bit of ground you can get.
I think so.
Which makes sense. Yeah, it's funny. It's just funny when you see it happening, and it gives me the... I think I probably went... and asked the ground to swallow me when I was standing there, but I had to keep my poker face and be like, yep, that's totally fine. But also, I guess it's weird when you live in live on tour all the time. You're just in perpetual adolescence. Like, we have one of the most grown-up, calm touring parties of all time. Pretty much everybody's in a long-term relationship. We're all quite calm and old. it's hardly like Motley Crue or anything. But, yeah, it is kind of weird, I suppose, because you have a tour manager, and this is your schedule every day, and you go from place to place, and, you know, there's food in the venue.
Right, you're being coddled and kind of taken care of.
I can see how, if that happened to you all the time, and you didn't make a conscious effort to make sure you remained a real person, then you could just live in this weird alternate reality where you can't figure out
how to... That's what I want. I just want to be in that bubble all the time.
Like, you want to have somebody print you out like a day sheet for like your off days.
Yes.
9 a.m. sleep.
Yes. That's what I want. No responsibilities.
And you need like a tour laminate to get in and out of your kitchen or something.
I just don't want to have to do dishes anymore. If I could just not do the dishes anymore or make the bed, that would be great. I just need to move to a hotel, I think.
Well, so I see flip side, when I'm in a hotel all the time, I'm like, I just want to do dishes. Not do dishes, but I get really paranoid about recycling on tour, which is maybe weird. But when you're in venues, a lot of the time, they don't have the facility to do dishes.
Right.
So they make you eat off like paper plates and plastic cups.
And that irritates
Then I start
you.
Doing the maths where I'm like, think about how many bands come through this venue, think about how many shows we play. And then in the end, I'm just in the fetal position in the corner
crying
about all the waste.
Could you always sing? Is that something that just came to you? I mean, was that always an ability, or was that a discovery for you? And as a follow-up, you seem like a fairly shy person. Was it difficult? I could be wrong. Was it difficult to then bring that gift to the public?
I guess for me, singing has always been part of what I've done when I've been writing music. I guess it is kind of a contradiction when you say to people, because I think as a person, I'm recently quiet. I don't really want to be like jazz hand, center of attention all the time. So when you say that to people, they're like, pretty fucking stupid job choice you've made. But I guess for me, I was maybe naive when I was starting to write music because I just wanted to write it because it made me feel better and I was communicating with people and saying something about something. And then I suppose the performance had to come out of that because otherwise you can't play it for anybody, which all sounds very Coyote Ugly.
No, it doesn't. I think it's probably helpful for people to hear that the performing can come out of the writing, I think is probably the reverse way that most performers do it.
I don't know. I just had to, I'm not 100% comfortable in the performance now, but I think I'm a lot more comfortable than I used to be. And it was a conscious effort and focus to make that happen because I wanted to be more comfortable when I was doing it, but also just, you know, I want to be giving the music the best chance we can give it. And if people are invested in that music, I want the show to be good and engaging and connecting with people. I think it was probably a long road to become comfortable with the voices, like literally your voice in terms of what you're saying in the stuff you write. But that's a completely different ballgame. Having to, and I'm not very good at the, it's Friday night, how we all doing? Like that kind of that kind of stuff. I think I need to work on a bit.
Hey girls, I can't hear you.
Everybody on this side say, oh God, it's not really, yeah, that's not a good stage. I'm like, okay, after three, we'll go, and think about how uncomfortable we all are. but, you know, I guess I figured it was good that we, I feel like it's always changing. It's always progressing in a good way, but I want to get there at our own pace.
You know? You strike me as a powerful performer. I mean, when I see you, you seem very comfortable in your skin and you project a kind of power. Do you feel that power?
Well, a TED Talk saved my life.
Oh, tell me about that.
It's sad, but it's not sad because TED Talks are awesome.
Yeah.
I used to get quite bad anxiety and panic attacks surrounding shows, which is weird because I never used to get that in previous bands, but the stakes were not the same. You know, and we were playing these big, big festivals. And for some reason, I just got this psychological tick of when you would walk on, there would be photographers in the pit for the first three songs. But at festivals, there's fucking hundreds of them, which is good because it means that people care about the band. But then if I was having a day which was quite anxious, then I would not be able to focus for some reason. And then,
so you were fixating on the photographers?
Well, I think I remember once, like, I was like, okay, we're starting the song, and I would be quite anxious anyway, and then I remember somebody left their flash on or something, and then it got like, I got all distracted, and then I was like, what bar are we on, where are we going, what's happening? And it was just like a spiral, which doesn't need to happen. And I watched a TED Talk by that lady Amy Cuddy, and it was about how your body language influences your mind and your mind influences how you hold your body and things like that. And she was talking about how she used to be a terrible public speaker, but it was all about kind of opening your body. And they did all these experiments where if they asked people to kind of cross their arms and legs and hunker down and see how they responded to a set of questions. But then if they asked people to do like Wonder Woman pose and open body language, it tricks your psychology into thinking that you feel better.
I became especially interested in nonverbal expressions of power and dominance. And what are nonverbal expressions of power and dominance? Well, this is what they are. So in the animal kingdom, they are about expanding. So you make yourself big, you stretch out, you take up space, you're basically opening up. It's about opening up. And this is true across the animal kingdom. It's not just limited to primates, and humans do the same thing. So they do this both when they have power sort of chronically, and also when they're feeling powerful in the moment. And this one is especially interesting because it really shows us how universal and old these expressions of power are.
I think that informed a lot of how we adapted the stage show. So now there's a lot of Dave Grohl rock stance, and a lot of fist in the air stuff, which started as a way to trick me into thinking I felt comfortable. But then I think then it kind of became the persona. And I like that it developed by itself. You know, there was a lot of people who were like, she's really shit at performing, she just stands there and doesn't really do anything, and blah, blah, blah. But I would rather do that than try and do a really awesome impression of Karen O or Janet Jackson or something, but it wouldn't be authentic, you know?
I asked Ingrid Michaelson, who I don't know if you know, but she's a singer-songwriter, when she was on the show, what the worst lyrics she's ever written are, and I'm going to ask you the same.
There's a few stinkers on the first, well, not the first record, I guess also because we demoed those songs and then started touring them before we'd really finished tweaking them, but you can't change the lyrics after that point. I regret the lyric Stuck in the Knife That You Held at My Back, because it's a bit cheesy, it's a bit trite, and also with my accent, a lot of people mishear it as Stuck in the Knife That You Held up My Butt. Are you to tell me how to keep myself afloat? I treaded water all the while. You stuck in the knife that you held at my butt. Did it make you feel so clever?
Oh dear.
Apparently. Right. And I was like, well, obviously that's not what I've said.
I don't know. Metallica said it. Metal up your ass.
And, you know, I am similar to James Hetfield in many, many ways. I am forever slaughtering animals and carrying them around like a purse.
Yeah. In the only band I was ever in, I wrote, one of my first songs was about racial politics in apartheid South Africa.
Oh, wow.
Something I knew nothing.
Which is important.
Oh, God. So pretentious and awful. So I know. So
you know the feels.
Oh, yeah.
Well, this is weird because now I'm like, but at that point, nobody had taken my heart and took a giant crap on it. So why was I all like, oh, feelings.
You were anticipating.
Well, but then, you know, chicken and egg. Did I will it into being
right.
So? I don't know. Was I sad because I listened to indie emo? Oh, did I listen to indie emo?
Because you were sad.
I remember one being like, yeah, this is going to be awesome. I'm going to take it to the guys. and it was like... we're in yesterday's paper with yesterday's news, but that does not mean that you have an excuse to rip me to pieces tonight.
Wow. I don't think that's terrible, I have to say.
That's really terrible.
I don't think that's terrible.
The cheese level on that is oof, oof.
I have heard from the only other Scot that I know that in Scotland and I think in the UK in general, there is a kind of attitude of... who do you think you are for wanting success? did you experience any of that?
I think I got it to a lesser extent than Ian and Martin got it. But I think that's probably because they've been around the Glasgow music circuit slightly longer than me. So, you know, we have a lot of really great friends who have been really happy for us and know that we all worked hard and put time and energy into what we've done. But I'm sure there are a lot of other people who were like, well, look at me. You fucking Billy Big Dick coming in here. But I think that's why it'll be nice for me to have a break from the city to an extent.
So now you're in New York and you can be sort of comfortably anonymous.
Yeah, nobody cares about me here because there's legitimate famous people.
Well, I mean, it was funny to me when David Bowie died and seeing those photos of him in New York. And first of all, not even realizing he lived here. And second of all, that he'd been able to sort of have a life.
Which was
great. I mean, it's great to read that and see that you... no matter how famous you get in Mayberry, you will have happy anonymity here in New York City.
Yeah, because I guess you don't want to... not that this is going to be the case for us, but I kind of feel like it must be weird when that becomes the only part of your identity, you know? Like, if you can't have the other parts of your life and your life is just being that persona and being famous, must be quite weird.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't know. I haven't shouted at anybody on the subway yet. I did a kind of guffaw at the person that shouted at me, and then I had a quiet cry in the corner. But it had been a long day. It'd been a very long day, and I had to do a lot of stuff I didn't really... It was like...
Are you a very weepy person? I feel like you are.
I don't know what happened. I didn't used to be. And then now I cry about good things, I cry about bad things, but only briefly. They're just like... it's like a little burst. You have to turn the tap on and then turn it off again. And then stuff that I think is really nice, I cry about. We do like fan club stuff. And people can give us letters in this little postbox, which is on the merch desk. And if they put in a stamped address envelope, we write them back. Turns out a lot of kids of the Twitter era don't understand how a stamped address envelope works.
Oh, how could they?
But, you know, when we get some of those letters or we talk to people at the fan club stuff, it's really sad sometimes and it's really emotional. Or if they talk about how it means a lot to them, that's insane because I was that teenager. I am that grown-up, but I pretend not to be. And, yeah, but at that moment they need me to be like... tough performer version of me and be like, you got this, you got your shit together. And then when they leave the room, I'm like, oh, this is so awful, and that happened to them. But you can't do that to them because then that's going to make them, when they're telling you something that's really awful about their life, if you cry at them, it's just going to reinforce, yes, that's terrible. You should be really upset by that. So I have to put on my game face. I'm like, but you got this. And then when they leave the room, I'm like, did you hear that one? It's so bad. So, yeah.
Do you think offstage Lauren would like onstage Lauren?
I don't know. I look at it as kind of like an ideal version of those parts of myself, if that makes sense.
It does.
I don't think I could walk around in real life being like that all the time. I think it'd be quite tiring. But And I guess it is funny because I feel like I don't read.
You like her in short bursts.
Yes.
As we wrap up, I end each interview with The Amazing Five, which is where I will ask you for recommendations or a recommendation in each of five categories.
Okay.
I will start with the most obvious, in your case, music.
I bought this morning, but have not fully listened to yet, the new Chairlift album.
I don't know who that is either.
And also, I got the other day a record by a band called Hopalong, which I like.
Say the name again?
Hopalong.
Hopalong,
like
a rabbit.
Yeah. Hopalong.
And what kind of music are these bands?
Well, Chairlift is kind of electronic stuff. And I guess living in New York, the chance of seeing live shows is much greater. Like, a lot of touring bands come through Glasgow, but not everyone. And I feel like, as and when I'm not playing shows, I will be able to see a shit ton of gigs here, and it'll be really good. So,
now, when you go to a gig now, do you still just pay for tickets like everybody? Or are you like, I'm going backstage, and I'm going to hang out where it's comfortable, and I'm going to have the snacks and the whole thing?
I would prefer to buy it and just have the gig experience, I think. Unless you know the band, right. In which case...
You don't want to intrude on bands you don't know.
No, I think that would be very uncomfortable. Well, maybe stage Lauren would do it, but real life Lauren doesn't want to do it. It would be very uncomfortable.
I totally get it. Books. You are a prolific tweeter of what you are reading, which I quite like that.
In my bag just now is Dear Mr. You, the Mary Louise Parker book.
Oh, yeah. I saw that she'd written a book.
Mm-hmm.
Is it a novel?
I would say it's quite Anne Carson-esque. Like, each chapter is written to a certain man in her life, whether that was a former partner or a father or a teacher.
But they're real people.
Yes, but you can't glean from the chapters who they are necessarily a lot of the time. But the prose is really beautiful. I think she's a really great writer.
Food. Do you eat meat?
I'm a kind of really awful, long-time lapsed vegetarian now, so...
So yes is the answer.
But I get scared of certain... I feel really bad about it. I think I feel really guilty about it. And the chicken doesn't know it's already dead. But
right.
And also, that's a really bougie thing. Like, I'm lucky enough to have the privilege to think about where my food comes from.
Oh, yeah, but...
But a lot of people don't.
I know, but you'll drive yourself crazy if you start.
And the other day, I ate a grilled chicken flatbread sandwich with guacamole in it, and it was really good. And then I felt really bad about it afterwards.
Why? Because it was a chicken?
Yeah. I was like, it's a horrible, you know, I shouldn't have watched Food Inc., basically.
Oh, yeah, I've avoided that for that reason.
Yep. I feel like I'm kind of figuring out how neighborhoods connect here. I walked past Eataly on the way here, and I was like, tourists must go in there and just die. They'll just get lost in there and never come out. And what did I went to that place, Supper, the other day.
What is that?
It was like a kind of Italian restaurant vibe.
And would you recommend Supper?
I would. It was nice. They had good specials.
Where is it?
Now you're quizzing me.
It in Brooklyn, Manhattan?
It was in Manhattan. It's on like it's really near Mercury Lounge.
Movies or television?
Movies. I saw Carol. That was really good.
Like Carol?
I did like Carol. I cried.
Well, I know you cried, but that doesn't mean you liked it.
No, I liked it. And I thought I guess they did it in, was it 16mm or something? And it looked really beautiful.
It does look beautiful. I will give you that.
And I feel like you did not like it from
It's not that I didn't like it. It's that I feel like it was a bit of a throwback in terms of subject matter. Like I would have loved that film. I would have probably loved that film 10 years ago or 12 years ago. Now I feel like the subject matter, it felt a little ho-hum to me. Although I thought that both performances were fantastic.
They were amazing, yeah. It kind of made me irritated, like the advertising of it in certain places I'd seen made it seem like a woman's movie. And then I watched it and I was like, this is such a sad, harrowing, touching portrayal of humanity
women,
and
of
relationships.
Women.
And but then people are like, well, it's for women. You know, women are going to go watch this film about women. Like, okay. It can't just be about human relationships and how they're complicated. It's about women. So that's my voiceover voice.
Oh, no, I got that. It's very good.
And what have I been watching on TV? I've watched one episode of Mozart in the Jungle.
Yeah, I suspect a lot of people are sort of sampling Mozart in the Jungle. Yeah. I haven't seen it.
But yeah, because I used to play the oboe when I was a young thing. Before the drums, we traded the oboe in for a drum kit.
Uh-huh. My daughter did the same thing. Not oboe, but it was flute.
Yeah. I was terrible at oboe. And then my flatmate manager was watching it, and I went past and just was watching them act with the oboes. And I was like, I should probably get into this. Well, figure out what's actually happening rather than trying to figure out if they're actually playing the oboe, which isn't the point.
Right.
So, but I'm interested to see where it goes.
Okay. And then finally, miscellaneous, which is anything from your life that you would recommend.
I have a lot of phone apps for meditation and mindfulness and yoga and
Tell me about that.
That sounds like you're going to mock me.
No, not at all. I'm fascinated by, we had a very good guest named Dan Harris who wrote an entire book about meditation.
Ah.
And I'm interested in it conceptually and have done absolutely nothing to implement it in my own life.
Well, I don't know. I read Catching the Big Fish, the David Lynch thing, and I was like, oh, how interesting. And then I didn't do anything about it. And it was only really when I was kind of thinking about pushing the reset button on the touring life and figuring out how to not actually go crazy, that I started to take it a bit more seriously. And I found a thing called Headspace, which was, it just makes you do it for 10 minutes. And it's like taking time out, especially if you've got shit tons of work on. It's about just like taking 10 minutes out of that. And I have a yoga app called Yoga Studio. And I used to think that yoga was very pretentious and wasn't mindfulness all very bourgeois, but no one's got actual time for it. And it's just very self-absorbed or something. But I don't know. I do think that doing it has made a lot of difference. And people can tell you that till the cows come home, how important it is to exercise for mental health. But it definitely, definitely does make a difference.
Lauren Mayberry, I want to thank you so much for participating here on How to Be Amazing. Thank you for your good work and continued good luck with churches. And thank you for being amazing.
Thank you for having me.
How to Be Amazing is brought to you by PRX. Like How to Be Amazing on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at HTBA_show. And check out our website at howtobeamazingshow.com. If you like what you've heard, please write us a nice review on iTunes. Say how handsome I sound. How to Be Amazing is produced by Jennifer Brennan and Mary Shimkin. It's recorded at Argo Studio, New York City. Today's show is mixed and edited by Jason Saldanha with music composed by Chad Crouch. Post-production work was also done by Barry O'Halloran. I am, as always, Michael Ian Black.